So, our fourth article under the term infections, we're looking at fungi. I'm going to immerse ourselves literally in the world of fungi. And this is really one of the most fascinating topics of all in this series. Fungi really do deserve respect. And the more we understand about them, the more we're fascinated by how organized, even intelligent, they are. So let's start at the beginning. They start off as small, tiny filaments called hyphae, which form networks called mycelium, mycelia, networks of these hyphae, which when they get to a point of reproducing, they form a fruiting body that we recognize in the wild as mushrooms, which then produce spores. In massive quantities usually, and each of these spores could fertilize, germinate as to form another hyphae, another hyphal growth. And that's life cycle is illustrated in the post, so you can see that at a glance. At various stages, the fungi can affect us at various stages of this life cycle. Let's look at some of the most common ones. So some, like Candida albicans, the one that most of us know as a human, as a threat, are what we call dimorphic. In other words, there's two forms. They live both as mycelia, as hyphal networks, but also a single, what are called yeast cells. This is slightly confusing because we think when we talk about yeast cells, we're talking about yeast, like brewer's yeast or baker's yeast. Yeast cells is a technical name given to individual cells that live as fungal cells distinctly in the body. Under certain circumstances, for example, when their population is threatened, these yeast cells then produce hyphae again. And that's important when we're understanding things like Candida problems, which we'll come on to later. So back to the mycelial networks. These infiltrate the surrounding tissues and substrates, the soil, for example, or the wood, wherever it happens to be, to look for nutrients to feed on. And they like damp and they like nutrient-rich material. And to find this food, these hyphae go into searching behavior. And it's really amazing to see how clever, literally, they are. They're constantly sending signals along the hyphae, which include electrical impulses like nerve fibers do, chemical signals, and moving nutrients back and forth. And it actually shows intelligent behavior. There's in laboratory, they've shown that hyphae can can navigate mazes, for example, to find their foods and show other intelligent behaviour simply because of the complexity of the impulses in them. So someone made the fascinating point that unlike plants, which generate their own food through photosynthesis, or animals, which ingest their food, fungi have to immerse themselves in their food. And this is the key, because they are therefore entirely reliant on their environment, on their food. And if you can control the environment, their food, you control them. So the key to managing the fungi is to reduce their food source. And that's what we'll come on to when we look at how to manage them in future posts, or future part of this post. So a bit more about fungi first, because it's important to get some principles here. They are highly cooperative. They rarely do form partnerships with other organisms, and we call them inter-kingdom alliances. And there's some classic examples. The one that we increasingly know about is their partnerships with plants. So we know that plants rely on fungal mycelial networks for their nourishment, and increasingly we see for their communication. So trees and plants will literally communicate with each other through their roots and their mycelial connections in what something we now call the wood wide web. And you'll see references to this elsewhere, that plants really do know about what's happening with each other, and the connections are provided by these mycelial networks. Another example are lichens, which is where fungi partner with algae. And what they do is they provide the algae with a moist environment out of water, so that they can thrive out of water in the embrace of the mycelial networks. And in return, the fungi get their photosynthesis, the algal photosynthesis, so they get their food from their algal partners. And almost all life depends on this partnership. If you take the example of, you know, a new volcanic island that suddenly comes out of the water, it's a bare rock. But the first organisms that appear on this bare rock are lichens. They seem to be able to thrive on and indeed digest rock as one of their properties, some of them. And that means they're generating soil. And the soil that the lichens generate is the basis of nutrient-rich soil that they generate is the basis on which plants can inhabit. And time and again, we see that fungi actually precede other life forms in the development of any living system. They get there first. They're the trailblazers. And in the case of lichens, that's a literal one. Another partnership is with bacteria, and this is a bit more troublesome for us because they form what we call biofilms. And here the mycelial network provides a framework on surfaces, particularly because they can adhere to surfaces and they can resist, you know, they provide their own ecosystem, and bacteria can move in with them. And what the fungi get out of this is the protection, the virulence, if you like, of the bacteria. The bacteria gets a home to live in. And as it now happens, biofilms are a major cause of antibiotic resistance because they're really quite difficult for antibiotics and other agents to penetrate. And these are some of the most damaging of health problems we get infection-wise, is because these biofilms that were formed. And a classic example of a biofilm is plaque in the mouth. And we'll talk about other examples later. However, and this is a really important point, most of our engagement with fungi is positive. Almost all our body surfaces have their own biomes, mycobiomes, which are fungal biomes, and these are especially found in the gut. And just as we saw earlier, it looks as though the fungi come there first. The mycobiome come before the microbiome. It looks as though the fungi in the gut pave the way for the movement in to the gut by the microbiome. And the microbiome actually helps to train the innate immune system. We saw there was a degree of training there. They prime them up. And surprisingly, the first organism found to do this was Candida. Candida primes various aspects of our immune system, including adaptive immunity. And notably, these benefits stay on and require it to stay on in the gut. So the immune system relies on Candida to keep itself up, primed up for defense. And it's particularly found that Candida protects us against things like Staphylococcus aureus in the gut. And there are other examples. The other major fungal inhabitant of the gut is brewer's yeast, baker's yeast, an organism called Saccharomyces. Together with Candida, this has protective effects on the gut wall, particularly against E. coli and C. difficile infections. So this is a thought. Candida and yeast are good for us, at least, mostly. That's worth taking account. They've got such a bad press, but actually they start out by being very useful for us. Problems occur when there are immunological defects and imbalances in the ecosystem, and then fungi are able to take advantage. They're opportunist. They will take advantage when there's we let them and move into places where they shouldn't. The most prominent that we know about is candidiasis, in which there is candida infections or infestations outside the gut. And we know this particularly with things like oral and vaginal thrush candidiasis in those areas. And also there are much more serious life-threatening systemic infections that are major causes of death in hospital. That's candidiasis, where the candida has moved outside the gut into the surrounding tissues. But there's a lot of confusion here. This invasion involves the growth of hyphae, we talked about earlier, through the gut wall and beyond. Candida overgrowth in the gut, however, involves candida yeast cells, the ones we saw earlier, single organisms, not hyphae. When these yeast cells are numerous, hyphae formation is not involved or invoked. So as we saw earlier, this only happens when yeast cells are threatened. So candida overgrowth does not lead to invasion, and diets aiming to suppress overgrowth in the gut will not stop systemic candidiasis. It's really important. There's a lot of confusion here that we assume because you've got thrush, you've got to get rid of the candida in the gut. No, it's a completely separate issue. The candida in the gut as such is actually not a threat to the rest of the system. However, there are times when candida can be a trouble, and they're very efficient at forming biofilms, including the plaque in the mouth, but also with gut things like Helicobacter, Streptococcus, various other organisms can form biofilms with fungi, and they're also found in the vagina with Lactobacillus. These are secondary threats that can cause quite a lot of trouble, not because of the fungi themselves, but because of the organisms with which they partner. So back to the question, if candida is a problem, what provokes the candida? If the biofilm is the problem, what provokes the candida and the bacteria to team up? And the answer is, as we've seen before, biofilms are a mutual survival strategy, where opportunities or threats present. So anything that alters the microbiome, such as antibiotics, changes in the host immunity, like another infection or immunosuppressant medicines, steroids, chemotherapy and so on, even stress can threaten the microbiome and can provoke the bacteria to seek harbour with the fungi as biofilms. So we're putting the thing back to the underlying causes, the threat to the immune system, the threat to the microbiome and so on, as where these problems originate. Breaches in the gut wall integrity can then be a problem, and that could be surgical, it could be excessive alcohol or drugs, liver and other gut diseases can lead to breakdown in those defences and can lead again to biofilm formation as a result. And it's worth noting that the major problem in hospitals with biofilms is nothing to do with the internal problems, but is to do with contamination of medical devices. It's very difficult to thoroughly sterilize biofilms on needles and other medical devices, and so most systemic candidiasis is a consequence of medical treatments. It's a hospital phenomenon rather than anything else. So back around to the review, another health problem we got with fungi are mycotoxins, and these mostly come from spores, and there's one or two like Aspergillus that produce some pretty powerful toxins, including aflatoxins, ergot and so on. These can grow on food items and cereals, dried fruits, nuts and spices are common sources of these dangerous toxins, and they thrive in damp and humid conditions. So to avoid these at home, keep your grains, dried fruit, nuts clean, discard any that look mouldy or discoloured, keep them dry, and don't keep them for too long. A key to managing any fungal infestation is to reduce dampness, and as we'll see, this is a theme that keeps coming back again. So we'll talk about them again in allergies posts, just to make a note here that if you're drying out a damp house, we'll come back to this later, don't do it too quickly or dramatically, because the fungi will see that as a threat and produce more spores. So if you're drying out an area, dry it slowly so that it doesn't threaten the fungi, or perceived as the fungi as a threat too much. So we start again, come back to the internal fungal problems associated with Candida. And as we've seen, most of this is down to reduced immune competence rather than, or immune breakdown of defences rather than to the virulence of the fungi themselves. So we look, when we're dealing with fungal problems, at things like gut health, gut wall health, and so on. Candida overgrowth in the gut, as we've seen, is separate from Candida invasion. It can be an issue if there is a disrupted microbiome, which of course means that we should focus on the microbiome when we're dealing with excess Candida in the gut. But frankly, a lot of the Candida diets are misplaced for the reasons we've touched on before. Some of them, for example, exclude yeast, which is counterproductive because brewer's yeast is a competitor to Candida and does not generate more Candida trouble at all. So the main potential advantage of a Candida diet is that it reduces carbohydrates and sugars, which might be useful in their own right. But it's unlikely that this will do much to reduce the Candida population. It's much more, this is a dysbiosis issue, and antibiotics are a major cause of Candida overgrowth in the gut. So the answer to that is to improve the health of the microbiome with all the microbiome-friendly foods that we talk about in this article and otherwise. So there's an interesting final thought here about dampness, and introduces us to what seems like a medieval idea. But most of the fungal problems would be associated with, in former times, would be seen as internal damp. The idea that dampness and disease were the same basic origin is a very ancient one. So in India, for example, the word for damp and disease are the same. And we associate in the West things like contagion, for example, and miasma. These are associated with dampness, with low-lying areas, with damp and stagnant areas. You know, disease was often seen to be associated with living near rivers and dockland areas and so on. That was an old idea, that dampness was troublesome. And many diseases were understood as so-called dampness in the body, because we didn't have instruments in those days, we didn't have some of the technologies we have now, and if you're looking at the body from outside, it does look as though it was full of damp. So we'll talk about those notions in other posts, but there were, for example, cold damp, which was something you find in the UK and Northern Europe, obvious reasons, and that's associated with congestion of fluids, with the sluggish metabolism, with a lot of mucus, with arthritis and joint pains, and low metabolic energy. Sometimes, you know, we just cold. The ados is hot damp or damp heat, various names for this, which we associate with an intolerance to humidity, with persistent gut infections, perhaps greasy skin, perhaps liver problems. These are old patterns that were well recognized in ancient times, and were seen as essentially the effect of damp on the digestive system mainly, and would have been associated with what we would now see as fungal problems, you know, whether it's, you know, canned thrush or things like athlete's foot or ringworm or so on, would be linked with these symptom patterns. And interestingly, the two most powerful digestive remedy groups that we will come back to time and time again were also classified as drying, in other words, anti-damp. And these include the heating and drying spices on the one hand and the cooling and drying bitters. And these are both key remedies in our, that we can still use today in managing fungal infections. And we'll talk about those more in the future post when we look at strategies for infections. But for example, in candida management, we could think of things like turmeric, cinnamon, garlic and cloves on the warming side and barberry on the cooling side. Again, there's more reading material here in a lovely book by Merlin Sheldrake called Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds and Shape Our Futures. As a good holiday read anytime you really want to be turned on. It's an amazing story.